What is up, Nets fans? Welcome to the Brooklyn Buzz. I'm your host, Nick Faye. With me, as always, Jack Manuel, and special guest today, Brian Fonseca of Nets Daily, also co-host of the Ain't Hard to Tell podcast. What is up, fellas? How are we doing?
What's going on, guys? I appreciate you having me on. I also appreciate the podcast being plugged right off the bat. I noticed that more and more people are doing that lately when I jump on their podcast, so that's pretty cool.
You got to do it at the top. You got to get it right so that people remember it. If they don't listen to the rest of the episode, Brian, at least they remember you. They listen to your podcast as well.
Right. Hopefully they follow it.
Podcast support is tough out here. We got to make sure we get everybody hooked up. But Brian, hope you had a great Thanksgiving. You know, we're going to get into some Nets stuff. As always, quick reminder, check out the Brooklyn Buzz, iTunes, Blog Talk Radio, OTGBasketball.com, NetsRepublic.com, Dash Radio, and YouTube. But right off the start, Brian, do you think the Nets have met expectations so far this season at 8-12?
Oh, we're getting right into it, huh?
Yes, sir.
But yeah, I will say this. Caris LeVert's injury, obviously, you know, that puts a dent in that, right? So you're looking at what could have been as opposed to what is in some ways because he's going to be out for the foreseeable future. I think that they would obviously be a better team if he was healthy. I'm not sure how much better, probably a couple games since it still hasn't been that long since he's been injured to begin with. But in terms of meeting expectations, I would say to me, even, you know, regardless of the Caris LeVert situation, they're not terribly far off from where I thought they would be because I had them being roughly 500 throughout the entire season. And I said, if healthy, they would finish with 38 wins. And in my scenario, they're getting an 8 seed. But now with LeVert out, you're probably looking at more 35, 33, maybe.
Yeah, I would probably buy into that as well. You know, I think I forecast for about 34 wins. I was a little less optimistic. I know Nick was around your range, Brian, with about 38 in that 8th seed. I think the Caris LeVert injury, you know, completely changes things. You know, obviously, I think you put it perfectly, what is and what could be. You know, with Caris LeVert, with the way he was playing, you could say that we were an above 500 team with the sort of amount of talent that we have and the amount of star potential that he was showing. So I think that we're probably about at that range. It's going to be, you know, going forward where we have these sort of tough stretches against some Western Conference teams and on those back-to-backs. You know, a guy like Caris LeVert could really help. And, you know, down the stretch and in the clutch, he was, you know, absolutely awesome in what he showed. So I think his absence is what really changes things going forward.
Yeah, and I pointed that out too when they lost to Minnesota their last game. And late in the game, as they were making their comeback, I felt like Caris LeVert especially would have been useful down the stretch there, yeah. Because you know you saw Dinwiddie trying to take over, which he has in the past. But then D'Angelo Russell was also struggling. He had one of his worst games of the season offensively. I think he only finished with 5 points. So you could have used Caris LeVert to sort of help facilitate, maybe help get D'Angelo going, or maybe help get the ball to Dinwiddie in some different spots and just give Minnesota some different looks. But, you know, obviously they're going to miss him for at least a couple months.
Now, talking about Caris, obviously you mentioned some of the closing games. How much do you think they miss him defensively? Obviously he was picking up the best perimeter player, you know, shutting down Devin Booker, Gary Harris Jr. How much do they miss him on that side of the ball with the rest of the team not being able to step up in that area?
You know, it's interesting because we focus so much on the offense, and just we as in like people in general just focus so much on the offense because that's what's easier to tell where the difference is. But Caris LeVert's defensive impact, like I remember Zach Lowe saying, I think it was at the end of last year, that Caris LeVert could be an all defensive player in the near future, which I took that as, hey, you know, maybe in a couple of years you start to see that. You started seeing it really this year, the defensive energy and the impact he would have on that. And obviously, you know, it was a smaller sample size. But I feel like in every area where he did take a step forward, he did so defensively as well. That just got kind of overlooked because the offense was just so much better than what we had seen in the previous two seasons. But, yeah, I do think they're missing him on that end also. And you could just see it. Even the ways they get scored on and, who's picking up the primary ball handler. Like, that one injury just changes so much, but especially defensively because, I mean, really look at it. Who is their best perimeter defender now? Is it Jared Dudley? You know what I mean? And I'm not even trying to be funny, but I'm looking right now at the roster. I'm like, I guess it's Joe Harris. I mean, I'm not quite sure. But LeVert is a lot better than what they have right now, at least defensively as well.
Yeah, I think Joe Harris probably is just due to be strengthened, but general basketball IQ. But Caris LeVert just has, like you mentioned, Brian, those tools and the athletic capabilities to like switch onto so many different guys. He has size about him that is going to make, you know, the smaller guards, you know, feel uncomfortable, like he did, like Nick mentioned, with a guy like Devin Booker and a guy like Gary Harris. He just has all these tools, and like he's got long arms. He knows how to deflect. He's really good at getting into the passing lanes. So I think it definitely changes everything schematically. And I think that's what the Nets have struggled this season on the defensive end, and losing your best defender. I mean, you can argue Rondell Hollis Jefferson has an impact there as well. Mm. But I think Jared Allen is our best defender, obviously, in the front court too. But you need a perimeter presence on the defense, because that's generally where you see teams with their best players, unless you're like Anthony Davis and Joel Embiid. Most players are, you know, the wings and the ones and the twos.
Yeah, I actually failed to mention Rondae Hollis-Jefferson. However, I don't really know what his impact has been this year in comparison to the last couple of seasons, where I see Jared Dudley starting games. And granted, he's not playing a ton more than Rondae has, but Rondae sort of had the injury. I don't feel like he's quite as sharp. I know he isn't as sharp, and you guys know from seeing him. So, I mean, I'm not really sure what to make of him going forward yet, but yeah, with Caris LeVert defensive impact, I mean, in this new NBA, he can guard four positions, and you're looking at that with guys that are coming up. They're playing Utah coming up, and Memphis as well. You know, you're looking at him potentially guarding Joe Ingles, potentially guarding Donovan Mitchell at times. Memphis, you're looking at him guarding Mike Conley at times. You know what I mean? And that just sort of changes everything when you lose your not only your primary offensive source, but your primary defender as well.
Yeah, and you mentioned Rondae. He just doesn't look quite as springy this year. The energy just isn't quite there yet. Maybe it's health. But do you think anybody can step up in the Caris LeVert role in terms of defensively?
I mean, I would think that it'd be Rondae, but he's also playing a different position though, right? So they're using him obviously more on the inside, and I haven't seen the Nets put him on, say, the other team's primary ball handler. Like, I'm not really so sure, because they need him in the post, that we're going to see him guard Mike Conley, that we're going to see him guard Donovan Mitchell, you know, coming up in those games, whereas you're probably just going to see Joe Harris, Spencer, D'Angelo, you know what I mean? Guys like that, Allen Crabbe, who's actually taken a step defensively. Maybe it's him, because Kenny Atkinson has mentioned that Allen Crabbe has looked better defensively, has looked better rebounding. And that's something that I've seen. I feel like when he was having his struggles earlier in the year and lately, you know, he's kind of debunked that, but he's not completely out of the woods yet, because if he has another 6-point game, then people are going to be like, here we go again. Yeah. But defensively, he has gotten better, back to sort of what he was earlier in his Portland days, because I remember he did have a bit of a reputation for being pretty good defensively. And then right before the Nets got him, he was, I think, statistically one of the worst defenders in the NBA. And then last year, you know, you saw kind of a little bit of development from that, I guess. But now this year, you started to see him play more defensively, which has kind of kept him on the floor, along with, you know, his ability to make 3-point shots, which he started doing lately. So maybe it's Allen Crabbe. I'm not sure. As far as in the starting lineup, you would hope that it's D'Angelo. You would hope that it's Joe Harris. But I guess you're going to have to continue to play it out and see.
Now, quickly touching on Caris real quick. Without Caris, do you think there's any type of possibility for the playoffs still or no?
I would love to know how long he's out for. But,
well, do you think he'll be back this season for sure, or do you think there's a chance the Nets are conservative and sit him?
Well, I do know that they're very optimistic that he'll be back this season. And they do believe that he'll be back this season. Everyone's of the mindset that he'll be back this season. Now, I don't know when. Reports have suggested that I think it was a NYU doctor, or not doctor, but there's a obviously a fancier medical term that I'm just not prepared to really go down that route. But they said probably 2 to 3 months. And that's generally what I also heard, as far as, you know, people that I've spoken to as well, is probably 2 to 3 months. My guess, my educated guess, would probably be the latter, not necessarily 2 months, just because, you know, the Nets are obviously going to take their time. And let's not act like Caris LeVert doesn't have a history of injuries as well. So I do think he'll be back this season, but you also have to take into account how much later in the season, how different the team could look by that time, and also how are they going to work him back? Because if you remember, D'Angelo was out for 2 months last year. He had that that arthroscopic knee surgery, and they worked him back like over the course of a month until he was back into the starting lineup. When he came back, he was playing like 17 minutes, 14 minutes, 18 minutes, and then he got into the 20s, and he was still coming off the bench in favor of Spencer. And then that sort of changed after the All-Star break, and then they started to try them together in the starting lineup at some point, and then that didn't work out, so they just put Spencer back on the bench. So, you know, there's no guarantee that if and when Caris LeVert comes back later this season that he's going to be the same either. So that's just another thing to think about.
Yeah, I think as well, we saw Caris last season primarily as sort of a bench guy, and he feasted on them. So I think he should take confidence from that as well. And obviously with the amount of, you know, upside he's shown already before the injury, you know, he's going to have his way with, you know, secondary units, if that is obviously not the more likely route. And who knows, by that stage, we could see, you know, we've sort of touted on the buzz before that Dinwiddie could be in the starting lineup by that stage, because D'Angelo looks like he needs another facilitator beside him. And, you know, does Dinwiddie take that role again? Because it was obviously, you know, you reported yourself, Brian, as well as other guys at Nets Daily, that, you know, Spencer had a tough time in readjusting to that role when D'Angelo did come back. So there's a lot of chemistry, a lot of sort of roster finagling that Shawn Marks and Kitty are going to have to do when Caris does come back. But whenever he does come back, he's going to make the Nets a better team, because he's shown this season that he has the potential to be our best player, and he adds so much value on both sides of the floor.
Right, yeah.
Yeah, hoping we definitely see Caris this year. But talking D'Angelo and Dinwiddie, you know, how would you describe their relationship?
That's an interesting question, because I can't say that I know definitively, you know what I'm saying, because I'm not hanging out with both of them necessarily. Yeah. And I do talk to Spencer a bit more, obviously, having, you know, done more stuff with him and things like that. But, you know, from what I understand, they're good. You know what I mean? They're cool. I don't think there's like necessarily like some sort of, you know, hate between the two or disdain like that. Like, they're, you know, working things out, obviously, from a basketball sense. And, you know, we're trying to see where that chemistry is on the court, because you would think that, and Spencer's also said this in the past, that you would think that two guys who could shoot, two guys that could handle the ball and do the things that they could do, that they could find that chemistry on the court. But he also said that they just had to practice a lot together last year, because, kind of as I alluded to earlier, right, with D'Angelo Russell sort of being in the starting lineup and Spencer Dinwiddie with the second unit, that's sort of how they operated in practice, obviously, in workouts and scrimmages and things like that. So they didn't get to play together a lot. And then D'Angelo got hurt very early in the year last year. It was like in November or something. And he was out for a couple months. And then when he was working his way back, Spencer Dinwiddie was with the first unit. D'Angelo was with the second unit. So it's just a matter of, these guys, even though they are teammates, and from the outside looking in, some people may find that hard to believe, but yeah, they haven't really just played together enough to sort of get that chemistry going. I feel like I remember which game it was, probably the one before last, where they both played well, the road win.
Washington.
Wizards?
Yes.
Yeah.
That you kind of saw it work there, right? So that kind of... Yeah. That kind of put an end to all that, I guess, for that game. But that's something that I've always been intrigued by, is I'm sort of like with Spencer, like, why can't this sort of work? You know what I mean? And, you know, it's interesting for a number of reasons, but, you know, that's something to look at going forward, definitely.
Yeah, you want to have the two best players on your team playing, you know, a majority of the time. And in the sort of the clutch stretch, you know, we mentioned, and you mentioned earlier as well, Brian, the sort of, you know, the chemistry issue going down the stretch, you know, unless both guys are cooking. And there was a game where D'Angelo was cooking, but Spencer sort of tried to win the game and sort of went a sort of little bit hero ball, which, you know, has worked for him in the past, as we've all said, and we've seen it last season and sometimes this season too. So I think chemistry is underrated more than any other sort of elements when it comes to basketball. I think, you know, you can have all the skills in the world, and a lot of these guys do, but how it meshes well in team context is going to be, you know, crucial for both their individual success, but I think that they can elevate each other individually too.
Yeah, especially when you're looking at a backcourt and what, you know, guys need things created for them, and D'Lo and Dinwiddie can do that. But staying on that topic, if you had to choose, Brian, which guy is more likely to be with the Nets next season, you know, D'Angelo or Dinwiddie?
Ha! Woo! Right. Because obviously when I think about this, I'm like, look, man, I'll say this much. I have no idea as of right now what this team is going to do. Like, I definitively don't know. I could see it going one way or another, but my guess, this is not reporting. I'm just guessing, right? Because Spencer Dinwiddie is going to be eligible for what I would say is, at least in this era of NBA salary caps, is a more team-friendly deal,
yep,
sort of moving forward. So I would see where they would feel inclined to give him that extension, being that you're basically paying a dude under the maximum in that extension, which is going to be December 8th. That's the first day that they could do it. It would be 4 years, $48 million, right? Spencer is 25 years old. Therefore, you would be getting basically his prime for $12 million a year annually, roughly. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So this is just me talking. This is just me. This is just how I'm sort of going through the situation. And if I'm weighing that, right, against D'Angelo, who, the way it's looking, he's going to get, I don't know what the number could be right now, because so much could happen between now and then. And this is something we overlook with D'Angelo Russell, too. He has to prove that he can get through the season healthy. You know what I mean? This is something True. That he hasn't been able to do throughout the course of his career, other than his first season where he played 80 games. You know, since then, he's had injuries that sort of dinged him up with the Lakers and then with the Nets last year. So he has to prove that he can sort of get through the season healthy, and this is a contract year for him. But I feel like, let's say all things continue, or the season ends today, whatever you want, you know, however you want to phrase it, right? He's going to be he's going to probably get a bigger deal, a much bigger deal maybe even, because people are going to see somebody in the league, if not the Nets, somebody's going to see, hey, 22 years old, he's done this for four seasons. And the tricky thing about it is, we overlook this with these young one-and-done players, is by the time they get to this first contract season or this first year that they're able to get a big contract after their rookie deal has expired, they're still so young. And if you're looking at Spencer Dinwiddie as just entering his prime at 25, D'Angelo Russell is still 3 years away from that. So somebody is going to come out there. If not the Nets, they're going to have to pay for potential. And that's looking like a four-year deal where when that expires, then he'll be entering his prime. So he's going to get more than what Spencer Dinwiddie's getting. So it's just a matter of, you know, do you love D'Angelo's upside more? Do you love Spencer sort of maybe, if you want to call it, a higher floor and at a cheaper price? Like, it just depends. It just depends on what you like.
Yeah, so many factors to consider. I would personally go down the Spencer route if I was Sean Marks, because, you know, it would be a value contract. We know it would be a value contract. Spencer hasn't had a lot of time in the league because he's been chucked around so many times before he was able to, you know, start to realize his potential with the Nets. And like you were saying, 4 years, $48 million deal, that is bargain basement. And if the Nets were to sort of want to pivot, you know, they could, you know, include a guy like Spencer Dinwiddie in a trade for like a big fish. And D'Angelo Russell, you know, you're paying for potential. Guys like Aaron Gordon, who got 4 years, 84, 4 years, 80. You know, Zach LaVine, 4 years, 76. And Miles Turner, I think it was 4 and 64, something, 472, around that range.
Right.
You know, that's probably what D'Angelo is going to want. Something above the $15 million per annum range. And has he proven that he's worth that so far? Probably not. But yeah, there's still a lot of time to go. And as he said at Media Day when he was taking over the Nets Twitter, that's his goal, to play 82 games this season. So if he does do that, then there's every chance he could command a big payday.
Yeah, yeah. Agree. And, you know, I tend to agree when I say that I'd probably go the Spencer route. However, I'm not overlooking that. Look, this is unlikely, but it's possible that they can keep both.
Yeah.
It is possible. It is financially possible. Now, they have to prove that, obviously, they can continue to sort of make this developments and progress and things like that, and obviously coexist on the court. There are a lot of factors into all this. We're in November right now. We're almost in December, and I can't even begin to think how differently it could look within the next couple of months.
Yeah, and you guys laid it out perfectly. A lot of it goes with money and what D'Angelo is going to do for these next 62 games. Moving on from Spencer and D'Lo, which I'm sure we'll talk about a lot this year, what's Kenny's relationship like with the players? You know, do they really love him, or is there some love hate? How would you describe that?
Yeah, no, I genuinely believe that everybody likes one another. Now, I'm not sure like who likes who more and that kind of thing, but I really don't think that this locker room has legitimate drama that the Nets used to have in, say, the Deron Williams, you know, days and things like that. Yeah, I don't think it's that. I do think that, you know, obviously they want to win games, so sure, losing could be frustrating. I'm not positive that that's Kenny's fault. I don't think that's Kenny's fault. And you got to remember, Puccio actually pointed this out too, but this is something that we've talked about. Whereas, look, it's tough because with Kenny in particular, your first year, you lose Jeremy Lin for a lot of the season. The next year, you lose Jeremy Lin for basically the entire season outside of opening night. And then you also lose D'Angelo Russell for that stretch we talked about earlier. And now this year, Caris LeVert's down. So you're talking about your lead guard, your lead ball handler, arguably your best player in each season, you know, going down. And that means that, you know, people don't want to do this 3 years in because they want results now and everything has to be instantaneous and things like that. But look, there's a lot of nuance as far as Kenny Atkinson's run with the Nets so far. And there's a lot of nuance into that record. And I do think that the players know that and they still obviously want to do more. I do think that players like being here. I don't think that's something that people would have said a few years ago. So I do think the culture, quote unquote, has sort of changed. But obviously, you know, they want to prove that they can get wins. I will say that Kenny Atkinson's player development should be highlighted as well, because that's how they've been able to get guys like Spencer Dinwiddie and put him in the rotation, even starting sometimes. And now people are talking about he's a sixth man of the year candidate. And obviously, I know he's happy here. Joe Harris is happy here. And he just got a contract. They got him for nothing back then. So, yeah, I do think that there's a mutual, you know, admiration and respect between the coaching staff and the players.
Do you think he deserves all the hate? I know you always post on Twitter, Brian. It's just like there's always Coach Kenny haters in your mentions. Do you think he deserves the criticism that he gets?
No, I don't think that. I mean, look, to a point, I mean, I guess. But it's like, but a lot of the criticisms they're stupid.
Irrational, you know what I mean?
You know what I mean? But I get wanting to play D'Angelo Russell more. I totally get that. I'm actually looking right now at their minutes per game, and Spencer Dinwiddie is averaging 27.8 minutes a game. D'Angelo Russell is averaging 27.7 minutes a game. They're playing roughly the same. But then when you look at the rest of their numbers, you know, Spencer Dinwiddie is shooting much better from the field. He's almost 46%. D'Angelo Russell is roughly 41%. Three-point percentage, they're basically both at 36. Spencer's been a lot better from the line. I would say that he's been better in late game situations for the most part outside of that Minnesota game. And, you know, D'Angelo Russell obviously closed out. I forget who it was recently on the road. Was it that Washington?
Oh, Miami. Miami. Yeah, no, Miami.
Miami. Okay, yeah. I'm mixing up all these damn games. Only 20 games for the season. But, yeah, like, you know, I get that part of it also, but it's like, look, there were times where fans have said that to me, and I look at the stat sheet, you know, while I'm at the game, and I feel like D'Angelo Russell has been playing that well. So I look at the sheet to confirm, and then I'm like, he's 6 for 18. Like,
yeah.
If I'm playing a guard and my lead guard is 6 for 18, like, I'm good. If I have a backup that's as good as him or playing much, much better, I don't need to play him. I don't need to play the other guy that much. You know, I could put somebody else in there. So it's just. Yeah, I don't think he deserves the level of criticisms that he gets it at. You know, do I think that there are some things he could do better? Sure. But I'm not a head coach and I can't tell you what they are. You know what I mean? Yeah. That's another thing that we sort of overlook, is that regardless of what your criticisms are of him and things of that nature, they know a lot more than we do. You know what I mean? They're with that team every day. They know the players a lot more. So it's like, look, I'm going to defer to him on certain things. And if there are things that look funky, then I'm going to question him about it. Sort of like I did at that last press conference where I asked him, I was like, yo, what did you tell Spencer on that play where he just pulled up in front of Karl Anthony Towns?
Yeah.
A question that he seemed ready for. So, you know, yeah, like we ask him about it sometimes and things like that. But I think it'll be fine, man. Like, you know, the criticism is the criticism, but I guess that comes with the territory as well, especially when you're in year 3 of a long rebuild.
Yeah. considering where the Nets were before they got Kenny, I think they just need to appreciate him more because, like you said, player development has been huge. Spencer, Joe Harris, Caris LeVert, Jared Allen's taken major strides already. And then you look at it, he's still developing as a coach too. So I don't expect him to be perfect, but the Nets knew what they were getting into when they signed him, and I think he's done a really good job, to be honest. Now, looking at the Nets...
Let me just say this one thing too. People forget that in this rebuild, they are ahead of schedule. With all the things that we're talking about, like Spencer Dinwiddie in a parallel universe, we don't even know if he's still in the NBA because the Bulls just kind of got rid of him.
Joe Harris as well.
Yeah, Joe Harris as well. And Allen Crabbe is probably, doing 5 points a game in Portland, backing up Evan Turner, who's backing up CJ McCollum. Like, I don't know. But like, people need to understand where they were a couple years ago, where they had guys like Shane Larkin, Donald Sloan, and then my first year covering the team, it was like Justin Hamilton, who I used to joke Brittany Griner could beat him one-on-one. You know what I mean? Like, honestly, like, they've come a long way in the last couple of years. Now it's just going to take more time to get to where you want to go to. So.
Exactly. And the touch on D'Angelo stuff you said, I agree. I think with Spencer getting more minutes sometimes, it just makes sense because D'Angelo is just not playing that great. And sometimes he's just not showing the energy too defensively. So I would go with Dinwiddie as well in a lot of situations. Yeah. Moving on from there though, real quick, an outsider would be interested, somebody like a Nets reporter yourself or writer or whatnot. What's one thing that's underrated about the Nets organization that someone from the outside wouldn't see?
Underrated about the Nets organization. Well, I mean, Jared Dudley talks about the practice facility and it is pretty dope. I will say that much. And I love that it's in Brooklyn, at least. Like, I can't imagine. Like, I don't get me wrong, covering the Knicks would be pretty cool. But going to Westchester all the time, man, like, that's probably not something that I would look forward to. But I don't know. I would just say, like, yeah, sort of those things, right? Just how good of a job the front office has been over the last couple of years in terms of, now they're not perfect. Sean Marks is not batting 1,000, but you look at where they were, where they've come from, and you're talking about fans are now trying to say that, hey, it's possible that they've won this Boston deal. Which is crazy. I don't know if that's true at all. I think we still need to wait. It's fun to talk about those things now, but you still have to wait, and 5 years or so to see how things play out, to see how good Caris LeVert is, how good Jared Allen is, how good Jason Tatum is, Colin Sexton, whatever. But the fact that it's even, I guess, remotely a discussion is pretty telling. You know what I mean? And the fact that their player development has been good, I think we still need to wait a little while to sort of see like some of these other positives sort of play out. But, by a while, I mean, maybe what's it, November now, probably 8 months. I would like to see where we're at 8 months after that sort of first wave of free agency, those first few weeks are over, because I do anticipate that for the first time in a while, you start to look at the Nets and being like, oh, they can get somebody. Now, I'm not saying that Kevin Durant is that somebody, but I do think they could get somebody who can make them a good deal better than they are now.
Yeah, we've heard that from Woj saying the Nets are very high on agents list. Same thing with Keith Smith has mentioned it. It's the Nets are actually getting some like love and respect, and that's just a weird feeling for Nets fans that they haven't experienced since, Sean Marks and Kenny came in.
Yeah, definitely. And it's like, again, it's sort of with that player development thing, right? I mentioned this recently, right? I don't think fans remember just how pissed off some of them were when Caris LeVert got drafted in the first round. I really think people lose sight of that because he was supposed to be a lot. First of all, a lot of people had never heard of him. I had actually seen him play in college, but he wasn't necessarily on my radar in anything that I did leading up to the draft because he was projected sort of not really in their area. None of us really knew what that level of interest is because that pick sort of snuck up on everybody, especially in that spot. Now, Dexter had reported and called the Isaiah Whitehead selection before anybody else did. That was the only draft pick in like the Sean Marks tenure that the Nets have nailed. I mean, that not that the Nets have nailed, but that we've sort of nailed before it even happened. And everything else has just been a surprise. So with that, I still want to see what Zanon Musa could do. I still want to see what Karuks could do. I still want to see what Theo Pinson could do. These guys, and Alan Williams are putting up big numbers in the G League. And I think that the Nets, while I don't know how talented they are in comparison to some of the teams that have better players, but they are deep. Like 1 through 17, they are deep. And they have guys who will be under control next year who should continue to get better. And I think people are sort of sleeping on that because we're not seeing some of those players play right now. But as long as they keep them within the organization, it could be pretty interesting to watch over the next couple of years.
Yeah, that's true. A lot of the G League guys have been really interesting. Alan Williams, the guy you mentioned, is something to keep an eye on. But talking about on the court a little bit, you know, obviously Nets Twitter, Nets fans in general, there's been question about the four position, Jared Dudley starting, you know, Rodion's not getting minutes, and, you know, Damari and Rondé finally being healthy. What do you think is the solution at that four spot?
I thought, you know, it's funny because, like, I remember in the beginning of the season when Rondé Hollis-Jefferson was still sort of almost back from that injury, but not quite yet. I remember Kenny saying that he had planned to just put him back into the starting lineup. Wow. And, yeah, and I had guessed that Jared Dudley had been doing so well from an advanced stats standpoint. Mm-hmm. That's kind of a tongue twister there. but from like, you know, analytics, and, you know, they're one of the teams that really, really focuses on that stuff. Well, that's interesting. I'm getting a phone call here. I'll get that later. But
so, who has phones these days, man? Is that a landline?
Yeah. It's actually a landline. It's one of them cordless joints because my cell phone doesn't have great service in here. And I'm just going to go through this while this continues to ring so that I can give my point after it's done. Are we good? All right, cool.
It's like 2003, right, bro.
They're going to call back now.
It's pretty convenient, though, because the service is good. They might call back because that's actually my brother. Who's downstairs? Why doesn't he come up here? Anyway, starting at the four position, you know, I thought we would have seen Rondé Hollis-Jefferson already, so kind of curious to me why we haven't, even though he's sort of been more productive, not from a plus minus standpoint, but just from an overall productivity standpoint. And it leads me to believe that his future is very much in question because, you know, he's in a contract year. He's one of these other guys who this is a big year for him. And we've seen his production dip just because he's not really getting the same amount of minutes. Damari Carroll, who is somebody I've had to look up, and I was like, oh yeah, that's right, he's here too. And he was somebody who was starting games at the forward position last year as well. So I'm not really sure. I think at some point we're going to see Karuks. I just don't know to what degree. And I know that they want to use Long Island to sort of develop these guys, but I think relatively soon, I think, again, this is not a report necessarily, this is just me, I would think that we'll start to see Karuks in particular, but maybe some of those other G League guys as well.
Yeah, it would be nice to see Rodion's.
Yeah. Rodion's has been so awesome. Karuts, every time he gets out on the floor, he just makes things happen. But I remember I did a piece a couple of days ago for OTGBasketball.com. Every game last season, Damari was healthy, he started. And 59 of 68 games, Rondé was healthy for, he started. So it seems, obviously, I think it was a little while ago, I can't remember who it was on Twitter, did post, like you were sort of saying, Brian, about the advanced stats and plus minus wise, Jared Dudley has added, you know, an extreme amount of value. But I'm not sure if it takes the last two or three games into account, because I think he has taken a step back, so to speak. You know, Nick and I spoke about him on the Buzz, and the amount of minutes he's playing in comparison to last season, even the season before, is just astronomical. So I think he would be better served coming off the bench. And his greatest value comes not on the court for me. His greatest value is, you know, a mentoring sort of role, and just being able to, you know, teach guys like Rodion, teach guys like D'Angelo how to do the right things, the sort of fundamentals of being an NBA-ready basketballer. So I'd love to see, you know, come game 75 that Rodion's Kuruts is starting, because I think he might be our long-term starter unless we were to get like a guy like a Tobias Harris or whatever. But Rodion's has just been so good, and I think he's probably on paper the best fit. It's just that he doesn't seem necessarily ready, and I think Long Island is a good spot for him to develop, because, you know, Jahnan's shown awesome things there, as has Alan Williams and Theo. So it's a good spot to be in, so to speak.
Yeah, let me just add this. I'm not overlooking that. And with Rondé and with Damari Carroll, they're both in contract seasons and both are slated to be free agents at the end of the year. I feel like there is also something to that with them being on the bench as well. Although in favor of Jared Dudley is kind of a little odd when you're using that logic, but you know, at the same time, it's like, I think that we're going to see a different team in 3 months at least to some degree, but really more so probably in 8 months.
Yeah.
Brian, right now, what would be personally your ideal starting lineup for the Nets?
You mean this current group?
Currently, right now, you know, going to the next game, you know, against Philly tomorrow.
Well, let's see. I would resurrect Caris LeVert first of all.
Well, if we could do that, I'd definitely be on board.
You know, I wanted to at one point see Russell and Dinwiddie together starting and then sort of have Shabazz take on a bigger role coming off the bench, but I've since sort of moved off of that just because I see Spencer sort of thriving in that role most nights than he's not. So I would sort of leave that where it is and have D'Angelo Russell starting at the one. And then I find it interesting that Crabb and Joe Harris are starting together, but I think, you know, Kenny just wants to really get both those guys going at the same time because he knows how much more effective they would be. For me personally, I would like to see Rondé at the four, Jared Allen obviously at the five, D'Angelo at one. And then from there, I'd probably stay with Joe Harris and Allen Crabb. But part of me would also perhaps putting Caruso there instead of Rondé and start him at the four just to see what he could do. Because as you guys alluded to, when he steps on the floor, good things are sort of happen, which is why it's curious to me that, yeah, I mean, you want to develop him in the G League where he's going to play more. But part of me is also like, man, just throw him in your rotation in the NBA. Yeah. Let me see what he could do, you know, as a rookie on this team who, you know, I guess they're playing for wins, yes, but with Caris out, I mean, there's no doubt that you're not as effective and not as competitive. So I would like to see what Caruso could do in this situation as well. So I'm not really opposed to starting him at the four either.
What about you, Jack?
Yeah, I would love to see Rodion's at the four as well. And I think we spoke about, and I know Nick really was a big advocate for Spencer starting. I personally, because I want my prediction of him being sixth man of the year to come true, for him to stay in that bench role. But, you know, I think D'Angelo would work better with another facilitator. And it's why he was playing well alongside a guy like Caris LeVert. It's going to be, there's just so many things to like mix around with. And that's why I think Coach Kenny deserves, it's a tough job, like we alluded to. Mm-hmm. And figuring out the right sort of cohesion within, you know, on offense and defense, you know, could Joe Harris come off the bench because he was such a productive piece there and he started the season so well and he's obviously had some up and down moments since, but we know in whatever role Joe Harris is going to do, he's going to be great. And I think in terms of Allen Crabb's confidence, you've got to leave him in the starters, I think, going forward. So does he need the ball, more plays run for him individually rather than a guy like Joe Harris? It's just there's so many, you know, different things. I'd probably, my favorite lineup would be, you know, D'Angelo, Spencer, Crabb, and Rodions and Allen. But I'm more than happy to see Joe Harris in there as well.
Yeah, that's your boy. Obviously, you want to see him there. Do you think the starting lineup or the line, what does the starting lineup need the most? Is it a slasher? Is it a defensive presence? What is it, another facilitator?
That's a good question. I would probably say a defensive stopper. I mean, granted, you could say that about most starting lineups, but, you know, this team, especially with the loss of Caris LeVert, they're sort of losing that. And that's how, you know, Minnesota had a really good start against them. There have been, like, some other games where I think in Caris LeVert's absence, I forget who else dropped 30-something in the first quarter. I feel like that happened. Maybe I'm mistaken. I'm not sure.
I think you're right. I'm not sure the exact date, but it just seems like teams are getting off to a lot hotter start.
Yeah, I mean, and that's – at the very minimum, that's something that Kenny Atkinson's talked about post-game, you know, where, oh, we came out slow, we did that. And Caris LeVert was obviously big there because there were games where he would have these big first halves and then, you know, other guys would pick it up in the second half and then he'll come in and close and you were, you know, getting something there. But then defensively, you know, you were also very much in the game as well. So I feel like, you know, a defensive presence, but obviously someone who could sort of make plays on offense because, I mean, you can't get somebody, no disrespect, because I really appreciate this player and what he did in the NBA, but you can't get somebody like Tony Allen. And
yeah, especially now.
Yeah, that's what I mean, like in this current NBA. Like, so I don't know where you get that at this point. I would like to see, again, I would like to see if the young guys could defend. I mean, having watched, now I covered the ACC tournament last season, and I got to see a good deal of Theo Pinson play high-level college basketball at that point. And, man, I was really impressed at his versatility and being able to play four positions. Granted, it was at the college level, but I saw how North Carolina was using him. So when I saw that the Nets were signing him afterwards, after the draft, I was like, man, that makes perfect sense because, you know, guys like him, they're versatile. And you could see what they could do. I think he's somebody who I want to see at the next level as well. We mentioned Karuks, but I want to see Theo Pinson to see how they can use him in that at that at the one, at the two, at the three, maybe even a small ball four. Because we've seen lineups. I remember seeing a lineup. It was like Dinwiddie, Russell, Crabbe, Allen, and I think Joe Harris was at the four. Yeah. Crabbe was at the four.
Yeah.
They used to have to close a game not that long ago, actually.
Yeah, you know what I mean? So they're just, you know, he said, Kenny Atkins says that they're just sort of going with the flow, seeing what works and whatnot. And I'm like, yo, if that's working at the end of the game, because I feel like we put a lot of emphasis on the starting lineup, but to me, and I feel like more people are starting to see this now, especially, but who finishes the game matters so much more. And I feel like more people are starting to see that because D'Angelo Russell, for example, whenever he doesn't finish a game, I know right away. Because before I could say anything,
Twitter lets you know.
Yeah, all I gotta do is look right at my notifications. Notifications are a trap, man. Look at it, and then they'll tell you right away. So, I mean, yeah, I think that's just more important than anything. But to answer your question, I would say, yeah, a defensive stopper would probably be more ideal before anything else because you do have the shooters. They just have to make shots. You have a little more size than you did last year with guys like Ed Davis and Kenneth Reed, who mysteriously is not playing that much either. But, you know. And Karuks, who mysteriously is not in the NBA either. Oh, he's in the G League, but still, like, you need that defensive presence in the absence of LeVert, definitely.
Well, you mentioned Fareed. Actually, sorry to cut you off, Jack. Do you think the reason he's not playing is just schematic fit, or is it just something different that we're not aware of?
No, I do think it's fit because, I mean, if you really think about it, look, Quincy Acey was a stretch four here, and he should not be a stretch four. Primarily on really any team.
In the NBA. Yeah.
But I'm saying that's not to say that he can't literally stretch the floor and shoot threes, but he's not Anthony Tolliver. You know what I'm saying? Like, he's not somebody who's primarily that. And they tried to use him as that last year. I think before that, it was, I don't know, I'm drawing a blank, but Kenneth Fareed, schematically, he's a 6'8 center because there's really no such thing as a power forward anymore as far as the traditional sense is concerned. And at a 6'8 center in Kenny Atkins' system, it's just tough to find those guys' minutes when you already have Ed Davis, who's bigger, stronger, and a better rebounder, Jared Allen, who's bigger. I don't know if he's stronger than Kenneth Fareed, but he's definitely, you know, your cornerstone at that position. And Rondae Hollis-Jefferson, who is of similar size to Kenneth Fareed, but who could just do more offensively and really more versatile on defense because he's quick enough to guard some of those guards where I'm not sure Kenneth Fareed is. So, yeah, I think it's more of a schematic standpoint. And I think that, you know, Kenneth Fareed, unless he develops a three-pointer, we might see the league just sort of pass him by, you know, because I'm not sure what the fit is right now, at least on this team. Maybe he could be sort of that junkyard dog on a different team that sort of needs that role coming off the bench. But with the Nets, with the fit, I'm not really too surprised on, you know, where he is right now in terms of playing time.
Yeah, unless injuries were to occur. But Nick, I'll give you a segue. I think the Nets could use a guy like Trevion Graham, I think. And he should be coming back pretty soon, I hope, anyway.
What is the latest on him, Brian? You know, obviously the Nets are very quiet when it comes to injury. Have you seen him around the practice facility or anything?
Believe me, I know. I actually saw him. When was it? It was, I think, last week. Went before one of the home games. I spoke to him briefly, and he just said, like, you know, he's hoping to be back soon. He's starting to feel better. From what I understand, I think he'll be back. The initial report that Shams said 2 months, but the Nets didn't really say, you know, they actually shot that down. From what I know, I think that it'll be roughly that. So we may not see him under that timetable, would be for another month. So I'm not quite sure. Maybe we'll see him in December. I'm not quite sure. But in talking to him, obviously he wouldn't offer up much. I think they're just literally monitoring it day to day, as they say. You know, we have running jokes about their thing, so we'll just leave it at that.
Yeah, I mean, and hamstrings are obviously, you know, something that can linger. I wouldn't be surprised if we don't see him until 2019. Now, you mentioned Rondé and his contract, you know, expiring this year. Do you think the Nets re-sign him in any scenario, or is he most likely gone?
Who is this again?
Rondé Hollis Jefferson.
Yeah, so, you know, I've been sort of like playing out this scenario in my head too, and I'm not quite sure either, because of how his sort of usage rate has dived down from last year, where he was, I mean, you got to remember, at one point he was like the Nets' leading scorer, averaging like 15 in the game and getting the ball in the post, turning and shooting, where he hadn't had a jumper this year before last year. I thought we would see more of that this year starting at the four. I actually thought we would see some level of improvement. But obviously, you know, with Jared Dudley starting and them going that route, that hasn't really materialized. So I could potentially see him staying on the cheap, but I don't know. They've sort of phased him out at the starting lineup in favor of Jared Dudley, and I'm not sort of ignoring that. I feel like going from that to staying on the team seems sort of hard to believe, but I'm not quite sure what his future is. And I'm not really sure what to predict with the team in general, but with Rondé Hollis Jefferson, I probably am inclined to say that he won't be back next year, but I'm not entirely sure.
Yeah, the Nets offense just doesn't flow as well when Rondé is out there at the four. You know, even at a small ball five, he can't defend guys as much in the post. He's a bit better at defending sort of the wings and even some of the smaller guys because he is quite quick laterally. So I think unless we were to get him on the cheap and he were to be like a bench guy going forward, then I don't think he fits, you know, the Nets sort of plans. Whereas I think a guy like Rodion Skuric, who is signed to a four-year, very, very cost-friendly deal, I think he fits in a lot more perfectly. And would a guy like Rondé, would his ego be able to sort of take being able to be a backup to a guy like Rodion Skuric? I'm not 100% sure, but what other team is going to want to take him and give him some sort of a contract, so to speak, whether it's like a qualifying offer or a short, you know, or a very cheap, you know, cost-friendly couple-of-year deal, multi-year deal? It's going to be interesting to see how it sort of pans out, but he does a lot of good things. He just doesn't impact the game in a very positive fashion when it comes to what the Nets are trying to do.
Yeah, I agree with that because I could see where his role would fit on a team that already has a ready-made offense, right? Like, yeah. It would be obvious to point out Golden State, for example. But for example, Golden State, right? So if we use them, he wouldn't really be asked to do much offensively and could help them out defensively with his versatility. It's like, that's a team he could play center on. You know what I'm saying? Like, not to say that he needs to be a center, but that's a team that where that would work. Memphis, I don't know about this current model. I have to see them a little bit more. But Memphis, when they were that grit and grind style, that would work there. You know what I mean? Like, you just need to find – he just needs to find a fit. And with, you know, other than the star players, with most of the guys in the NBA, what we fail to realize is that fit matters more than anything else for most of these guys. And a lot of guys like Spencer Dinwiddie right now, he's in an ideal situation. Rondé, I don't really think he is right now. So, you know, he needs to sort of find that ideal situation. Maybe it could materialize here. I'm not quite sure, but sort of moving forward, I find it hard to believe that he'll be here, you know, after this season. But again, I don't know that because this team has surprised me before, surprised other people that report the team closely before. So, yeah.
Yeah, and then obviously you see the lack of development. His three-point shot obviously has really hurt his chances to re-sign. Talking about another guy whose contract's expiring, Damari Carroll. Do you think the Nets will look to trade him at the deadline or just keep him throughout the contract?
I would think that it'd be tough to see him last the rest of the year and not get moved just because I feel like, well, I mean, unless they're competitive, right? This all is assuming that the bottom sort of falls out or that they're just not as competitive as it would have been with Caris LeVert. Now, with Caris LeVert here, that sort of changes things because maybe instead of this, what are they, 8-12 right now as we're recording this? Yeah, instead of that, maybe they're 10-10. And maybe they're around 500 or at 500 the rest of the season, right? So maybe you're keeping some of those guys and being competitive and things like that. But in terms of, let's say after another 10 games, because we're 20 games in, let's say after another 10 games, they're 3-7. So therefore they're, 11-19. And then it just keeps getting that bad. Then yeah, you have to start selling and you have to sort of look towards your future. And Damari Carroll is somebody who, I'm not saying that you're going to get like a high level first round pick. I don't think that's really realistic, but, and he's actually not as easy to move because he's an expiring contract, and somebody else is probably going to want to get rid of an expiring contract to take him on, even as they're being competitive. So I'm not quite sure what the value is there for him in that sense. But yeah, I mean, it all depends on how these next 10 games are actually pretty big. Now that I'm thinking about it, these next 10 or 20, because these next 10, you're probably looking at, you know, mid-December by the time that run is over, and probably 10 more after that, you're looking at early to mid-January. So, and by that point, you're halfway through the season and you're a month away from the trade deadline. So it all really depends on what their win-loss record is, because I think that I would feel inclined to keep some of these guys in favor of being competitive if they start winning some games. But again, if they get through one of those lulls and they win two of their next 10 and then four of their next 10 after that, and they're just at a run where they're 6-14, I guess that makes them, then yeah, you have to start looking at parting with some of these guys.
Yeah, I mean, if we can compare it, you could compare it to maybe a guy like Trevor Booker last season, who was moved around that sort of mark on the expiring contract to Philly and then eventually landed with Indiana. I think, yeah, it all depends on situation. You know, plenty of guys could use Damari. Zach Lowe has mentioned his name ad nauseum in places like New Orleans and then Houston, guys that could use the wing, who could hit the three. He's the sort of perfect sort of guy for that sort of mold, and he's an expiring contract. You know, it wouldn't surprise me if Sean Marks were to flip him and get another sort of pick involved, because we already took him on as a salary dump and got that first rounder as well. So he's already... And second rounder, he's already added in a tremendous amount to the organization in terms of what he's brought individually and then what he's brought along with him with those picks. So I think Damari's situation is going to be fascinating, because he does have a really good relationship as well with a lot of the guys in the roster, especially D'Angelo Russell too. So it's going to be interesting to see how it all plays out.
Yeah, and Coach Kenny too, you know, obviously, you know, coaching him at Atlanta, being that vet to kind of help him set the culture. Like you said, Brian, I think actually the next 10 to 20 games is really, really big for the Nets, and we'll have a better idea where they're at. Talking about trade speculation, there's been a couple rumors. I wouldn't even call it rumors. I think it's more just like Nets Twitter. They've talked about possibly making a move for Markelle Fultz or getting involved in what's going on with Washington and picking up one of those guys they're looking to move. Do you think there's any chance the Nets get in trade talks with either of these teams?
Now, this Markelle Fultz one, right, that's something I sort of played around with in my head, but I have a hard time. I have a hard time seeing him doing that, just because I don't think that you – that's something that I don't think you do straight up. Now, if Philly would want to give up a first-rounder, but then you have to be like, hey, this first-rounder is probably going to be in the 20s. This is really going to be worth it. But then, hey, this is also where we found Caris LeVert and Jared Allen, so we kind of made this work in the past. And then, by the way, we also got two other first-round picks that we could potentially package and move up if we wanted to. So, you know, you sort of play around with those possibilities, and then you get down to, well, Markelle Fultz is broken. Do we really want to be, you know, have this guy in our organization where he may seem like more of a liability than an asset? I'm not entirely sure. So with me, I don't know if I see that. I would be pretty surprised if that actually becomes a thing. I know that it's fun to talk about, but with D'Angelo Russell and Markelle Fultz, I mean, that would send an interesting message, wouldn't it?
Some people are saying, and these are a lot of non-Nets people, and they somehow, for some reason, have gotten the blue tick. Someone advocated for... I'll call him Josh Eberle, I think it was, or Justin Rome. One of those guys went for a straight up D'Angelo Russell, Markelle Fultz trade. And I'm just like, does this person like watch any Brooklyn Nets games at all? It just makes absolutely no freaking sense. And it was just, it got me pretty angry. But I tried not to comment, and I did my best. But that just doesn't make a lot of sense. Whereas both of those guys together, that's tantalizing. You know, when we took on, you know, another Philly guy in Jahlil Okafor, there was, you know, that sort of that excitement surrounding it. Obviously, Jahlil had his issues, and he did mention those, and we wish him well. And Markelle has probably similar issues if we're talking about sort of, you know, his sort of level of not just physical mentality, but he's also, you know, mental capacity as well. But the Nets are, you know, the way that they can transform guys, you know, you wouldn't put it past them. But yeah, unless it's for the right deal, like you mentioned, Brian, there's no point in doing it.
I think that people are overlooking that contracts have changed a lot over the last few years. What I mean by that is D'Angelo Russell, who was the second overall pick in 2015, is making, I think, roughly $5.5 million or something close to that this year, right? Markelle Fultz this year, this is the second year of his deal, is making $8.3 million.
Gross.
Right?
Gross.
Yeah. Next year, next year, because remember, in order to do this deal, you have to be cool with losing a little bit of cap space because Markelle Fultz is on your roster. Now, if you think you could turn him to something, sure, it's fun to talk about. Again, none of this is like actually happening as far as I know yet. But it'd be pretty exciting if it was, just from an entertainment standpoint. Anyway, then next year, Markelle Fultz, you're looking at $9.7 million, roughly $9.8 million, almost $10 million. Next season, $10 million for Markelle Fultz, who you're not even sure if he's going to have a jump shot by the end of this season. And then the year after that, if you want to take that fourth-year team option, that is over $12 million. So these rookies now at the top of the draft, the money is a little bit different, whereas they're getting way more than mid-level extension for getting back in the day and things like that. So you're not only eating just sort of like, is he liable? Is the shoulder ever going to be fixed? You're also taking in a lot of money that's going to cut into your cap space and limit your chances at going after some of these big guys if you want to get, you know, try to get two max players together or something like that.
Yeah, and that's an excellent point, Brian. And the fact is, like, Markelle Fultz hasn't really shown enough on the court where you're like, you know, I'm willing to take a chance on this guy. And this isn't even including, you know, his confidence issue. I think there's some concern maybe about his, like, team or whatever, releasing things, his agents and whatnot. And it doesn't seem like a player that the Nets would want to deal with.
Yeah, I mean, you know what's interesting is that the love affair with him, I've always been intrigued by this because – before the draft, I remember a lot of people saying that, oh, first overall pick, definitely, whatever. And a lot of people, I question as to whether they've actually ever seen him play. Not to say that he wasn't good in Washington because his highlights are amazing and things like that. But I just don't know that people really knew that much about Markelle Fultz beforehand. That was just something that was interesting to me. And then how
they just saw the numbers.
Yeah, and then how Philly has sort of handled this situation. It's been kind of questionable, but I do think that he's somebody that is sort of trade bait now because, you know, judging from what Woz was saying on a podcast, it seems like with Philly, they want to win now. And they've made that clear with the acquisition of Jimmy Butler and just how everything is going on in the organization. So it's kind of like, look, we want to win now. We don't have time for Markelle right now. And this is where people are sort of inserting the Nets, where it's like, look, if you want to win now, why don't you try to swap him and D'Angelo Russell? Whereas if you're the Nets, you're like, we kind of need a little bit more than just Markelle Fultz.
Yeah, I literally just got a notification from Bleacher Report saying via the Philly Inquirer that he may not be part of their long-term plans and they want to trade him. So they've clearly been listening. Maybe that's who the phone call was from.
Yeah, it's entirely possible. Like, look, that's not something – look, with the Nets, I tend to not rule anything out of play. And obviously, they keep everything very, 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 very close. So when we do get some information – then, you know, thank God. But, you know, it is what it is. But, you know, yeah, I think the Markelle Fultz thing is something to monitor because I'm just not ruling out anything as a Nets reporter because of what I've seen over the last few seasons. But that's not something that I'm going to say, hey, I expect them to make that deal. But I don't think D'Angelo for Markelle straight up would necessarily get it done. That's just my guess.
Yeah, I don't think it would either. It's not a very good trade for the Nets. Talking about Washington, obviously all the rumors and whatnot coming out about them. Do you think the Nets could get involved with some type of trade with them?
Yeah, so we sort of talked about – I remember me and Bob Windrum, obviously, who runs Nets Daily, were putting this out. The blow-up of that team, or the plans of it anyway, was getting announced. That Otto Porter is something that they could revisit. Now, obviously, he's not having as good of a season. I question as to whether that's actually him or the team around him and all the catastrophe that's going on in Washington, D.C. right now. But that's something that I would look at and really be curious as to whether or not they want to do that. Now, going back to money, that's going to eat up. You think Markelle's bad? That's going to eat up a lot of. We're talking about something in the neighborhood of $20 million a year for the next multiple seasons.
It's like 26 or something.
Yeah, more than that. I remember I posted the photo. It was like 24, then 25, then 26, something crazy like that. And a player option where it's like Allen Krabs, where it's like, obviously, he's going to take that.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like, he'd be dumb not to. But Otto Porter is obviously the name because they put a lot of disincentives, more disincentives in his contract than anybody else's, that they've tried to get Tyler Johnson, you know, Alan Crabb, whatever. So they did want him, obviously, if they did all that. They wouldn't have tried to get him to sign the offer sheet to begin with. Now, Bradley Beal, because I don't think John was, you know, I don't think that's realistic. I mean, come on. You want to talk
contract?
Want to go back to that money conversation?
Oh man,
Christ! Holy, like yeah. But with Bradley Beal, obviously that's going to require a steeper price. Now, yeah, if they're willing to blow it up, sure. I guess you know I was actually surprised that they wanted to blow up everything as opposed to keeping Bradley Beal and just you know getting new parts around him. But you know, with Bradley Beal, it's going to take more, and I just don't think that the Nets are going to pull off that kind of a deal right now. Maybe if down the line, if in January they were competitive and Caris LeVert's coming back, or if he had still been healthy around that time, it looks a little bit different. But these sort of things, they're just very, very hard to predict in November. But the Otto Porter thing is not something I'm sleeping on, although that contract would scare me a little bit. But the Nets obviously felt strongly about him at one point, and my guess is that in getting him, that would probably be your stretch four, and that they think he can play as well as he did in Washington before, you know, they signed him to the deal and his production dipped. Again, that's just my guess.
Yeah, I mean, I think that there's also an element of Sean Marks being weaponizing, I can't remember who was that said this on some podcast, but weaponizing the CBA and the salary cap and going, okay, well, if we can't get this guy, we're going to make you pay him, even if you don't necessarily 100% want to, because you're going to be our competitor. And Miami and Washington are two teams who are around that playoff mark. You know, the Wizards have more talent on paper. The Heat don't. You know, I think the Nets are as good as the Heat, and they've proven that this season going 1-1. So if you're going to go out there and go, okay, well, then we'll make you guys pay him, and that'll, like, eat up all your books going forward. And whereas us right now, with the situation the Nets are in, Miami Heat would trade anything on their roster, as would the Wizards, to be even close to the situation and have the flexibility that the Nets have. So I think Sean Marks is looking at sort of both routes in that sort of sense and going, okay, if we can't get him, we're going to make you eat up all your money and have, like, no flexibility. And I think flexibility is key. I think he's preached that a lot for going forward for the Nets. And it's going to be a big, obviously, off-season. And like we were sort of talking about with D'Angelo and Spencer, does he want to change route completely and sort of go for a guy like Otto Porter, who he's shown interest in, but then not have the flexibility going forward for a guy like, whether it's KD, Kawhi, Tobias, Chris Middleton, or whoever. I think it's going to be certainly, like, you know, Brian's mentioned about other topics, one to monitor.
Yeah. As you mentioned, you know, Sean Marks has mentioned cap flexibility a lot of times in press conferences. I'm sure Brian could confirm that. So I don't think he'll go to Porter route. I wouldn't be surprised, but it would just wouldn't make sense to make that move now. Maybe they strike out in free agency. They can't land anybody. They go for Otto Porter. But at this point, I think they keep that flexibility. Brian, before we get you out of here, one last question, you know, a holiday theme one. If the Nets could request one item from Santa Claus, what would it be?
RJ Barrett.
Not Zion? Not Cam?
See, I've been on the RJ Barrett is better than Zion train for a while, I think he's all around better. I think that me having seen him up close obviously helps, although I do plan on covering when they play here at Madison Square Garden in the not so distant future. That's actually next month. Nice. Hopefully that will work out. But RJ Barrett, I've seen him up close for 2 years. So let me explain how. He was at Geico Nationals, formerly known as Dick's Nationals, National High School Basketball Showcase tournament. He played at Montverde High School, where D'Angelo Russell used to play, where Ben Simmons used to play together at one point, actually. And RJ Barrett was in that tournament last year in 2017, and again this past year in 2018, and both years that I saw him, I felt like he was the best player in the tournament. Having watched him, and I had seen highlights and stuff, but having watched him up close, I was like, oh yeah, to me, this is the first overall pick in 2019, definitely. And he was originally 2019, then he reclassified to 2020, so he was a sophomore at the 2017 tournament. So this was at the time a sophomore dominating a whole bunch of upperclassmen at the high school level, averaging, I think, 25-9 or something like that. Then he reclassed back up to 2019 or back down to 2019, however you want to phrase that. And this past year when he was a senior, yeah, he was MVP of the tournament. He led Montfort to a championship. And to me, he's just the best all-around scorer. With Zion Williamson, no disrespect, but when I was looking at his high school tapes, I kind of just saw him dunking on little white kids from South Carolina over and over and over again. So I was just kind of like, yeah, athleticism, amazing, but is he more than that? I feel like at Duke so far, he's demonstrated that he is more than that. Now, to what degree, I don't know. I still think RJ Barrett's a better all-around player, and I would take him with the first pick. If you did take Zion, I wouldn't begrudge you. I would just point out that RJ Barrett's game probably ages better than Zion Williamson's.
This has been a debate in the OTG group chat for a while. You've had the RJ fans and the Zion fans. But, Brian, really appreciate you hopping on, talking Nets with us for over an hour. Tell everyone where they can find you on Twitter and find all your work. I'm sure most of the listeners already know, but just in case.
I mean, I would hope so. You would think that more Net fans would cross over to the Ain't Hard to Tell podcast, but since we don't only talk Nets, that's probably not the case. but we're doing all right. I would say, if you could just support us, Ain't Hard to Tell podcast. That's AHTT podcast on Twitter, on Instagram. We have a sale going on right now for merchandise on our TeePublic backpack broadcasting store. We've posted about that. And our Patreon page because, we ain't rich out here. So, we're trying to obviously, do some cool things. So if you guys could help, if listeners could help, that would be appreciative. And then for me, it's just Brian Fonseca NY. I'm sure the spelling and all that stuff will be available on Twitter, on Instagram, where, obviously, as you mentioned, I cover the Nets, but I also cover a bunch of other things like college basketball, sometimes high school sports, and then obviously MMA and boxing. So, yeah.
Yeah, Brian's definitely versatile. He's got all the sports covered for you. Brian, again, big thanks. Jack, always a pleasure. Thank you, everybody, for listening. Make sure you check out the show, iTunes, Blog Talk Radio, OTGBasketball.com, NetsRepublic.com, Dash Radio, and YouTube.